Welcome to the Chinese Canadian Museums podcast, The School Room. I'm your host, Melissa Lee, CEO of the museum. Thank you for joining us. Today we are discussing an often overlooked part of Newfoundland and Labrador's history, the 1906 Act respecting the immigration of Chinese persons. While the head tax that Chinese immigrants entering Canada were forced to pay under the Chinese Immigration Act from 1885 to 1923 is quite well researched and widely discussed today, Newfoundland did not officially join Canada until 1949. But in spite of this, Newfoundland actually had its own mirror policy to Canada's head tax that was introduced in 1906. So today, we're very excited to welcome Gordon Jin on The School Room. Gordon is the president, as well as one of the founders of the Newfoundland and Labrador Head Tax Redress Organization. Hi, Gordon. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Melissa. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for being here. So as I said, Newfoundland was a separate dominion to Canada until 1949, yet it actually implemented its own head tax. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about that history? What situations led up to this act, and how was it similar or different from the Canada's head tax?
Okay. So there have been instances of immigration of Chinese men into the Dominion prior to the imposition of this head tax, but it wasn't until 1895 where there is recorded history of two Chinese gentlemen coming to St. John's, Newfoundland. Actually, they came from Quebec, where friends of theirs told them, go to Newfoundland, start a business, you know, start a new life. So this was the first two recorded Chinese gentlemen that we have in Newfoundland history, the archives. But since their arrival in 1895, that started a trend of more Chinese coming to the Dominion Newfoundland. It wasn't a province of Canada at the time. And of course, if you were coming from China, you could not really enter, Newfoundland without paying some sort of head tax at the time, and that would have been $500. In Newfoundland in 1906, the head tax that was imposed was only $300. So in terms of economics, it was easier coming to Newfoundland than it was coming within Canada. So around the time leading up to 1906, there was quite a number of Chinese people coming to the Dominion. And actually in early 1906, there was a recorded mention of 50 Chinese men stepping off a boat, which started a stir amongst the community, and which kind of led to more discussion at the government level. And that's what started this discussion about imposing a head tax of typically similar to what Canada had at the time, 500, but I think during the review of the monetary amount, they reduced it to 300 for Newfoundland. But that head tax started in 1906 and didn't end until 1949 when Newfoundland joined Confederation. So we had a head tax for 43 years. And the difference between ours and the Canadian one was, I guess, Canada had a head tax dating back to 1885 to 1923, and amounts range from $50 to $100 to $500, but ours was strictly $300 for that 43-year period. The numbers in terms of those immigrants that were taxed were much smaller. We think maybe upwards to 350 to 400 men were head taxed. I don't actually have the exact numbers, but the head tax certificates that we could sort of log and find through the archives in terms of the people that were taxed showed up to around 350 to 400.
Okay, so let me get this straight. So in Newfoundland, the head tax lasted a lot longer. It started in 1906, didn't end until the 1940s. And the other thing is that it was $200 less than the overall Canada one, which did that make Chinese immigrants more likely to want to immigrate to Newfoundland because it was cheaper, or we don't know?
We don't know, but it is possible because the profession or the type of job they had when they came would have been a laundryman, because most of the head tax certificate showed the occupation laundryman. So the equivalent of that $300 at the time was about 2 to 3 years of your wages. So on the pure economic scale, in terms of monies, some never really recovered, like whatever they had in terms of the monies that either were provided to them or they had to repay back, and some never paid back that debt ever, as far as I know. I'm not even sure to this day how my father came to Newfoundland. I do know in the research I'd done and in the presentation I did for the rooms that the research showed that my grandfather had come to Newfoundland as early as 1911, left on several occasions, came back, but eventually left in the summer of 1930 to go back home. I think the plan was for my father to come at the time. He was only 15, 16 years old when he came to Newfoundland. So in order for him to come over, my grandfather had to go home to maybe take care of the family homestead. My father had a younger brother by 10 years, which meant my uncle would only have been 6 years old at the time when my father came to Newfoundland. So I think a lot of those things have happened when they left the CI-9, I think certificates they had to sign off would allow them to leave the Dominion Newfoundland for 2 years max. And when they came back, they wouldn't be taxed a second time. So one of the things that they tried to do was to go home. And this was prior to the war. So when the war started, there was no outbound, inbound immigration at all. In our records, you see that span between, I think, when Japan invaded China between 1937 and when the war ended, there was hardly any immigration to Newfoundland or any outbound back to China, simply because it was too dangerous.
You mentioned a little bit about your dad, and maybe we could move there and talk a little bit about your personal history to Newfoundland. So your dad, we understand, immigrated to Newfoundland in 1931 and worked in laundries, restaurants, had his own snack bar. Can you tell us a little bit more about his journey?
Yeah, so I think what I can sort of piece together, and he never talked about it a lot because I think their primary motive for raising their kids was to get them educated, like myself and my sister, and to sort of, they didn't want the kids to go through the life that they had of long hours, 7 days a week. So he started working in various laundries when he came over in 1931, as far as I know. I've been in some of these laundries because when I was born in the late 50s and growing up in the early to late 60s, there were still hand laundries in existence in St. John's at the time. So I was fortunate enough to see some of those hand laundries. But that kind of disappeared with the advent of automatic washing machines and that sort in the households. But my dad went through that progression of working in hand laundries to the point that when his brother came over in the late 40s, they kind of venture off into more of a retail business, a restaurant. That predates my time since I was born, but when I was born in the late 50s, they already had a snack bar in operation, and that went on to the time he retired. So he went from laundryman to running a restaurant to then a convenience snack bar business, which tends to be typical of many of the Chinese immigrants at the time, because many of them didn't have a professional sort of education. You know, they did what they could given the jobs that were available to them in St. John's. So,
and what's the difference between a snack bar and a restaurant?
A restaurant would have been more of a sit down, order from the menu, you'd be served a meal. A snack bar could be a corner business like what my dad had when I grew up. Little diner with just a countertop, and you go in and you weren't there for hours on end type of thing. It was a smaller operation. Many of them were mom and pop diners. A lot of my friends that I grew up with of Chinese descent had restaurants. Some had restaurants, some had these mom and pop type diners that are no longer in existence today.
And what's your favorite memory of your dad and of the snack diner or the restaurants? Do you kind of have a kind of memory where you always remember your dad doing something there or cooking something or favorite customer?
I think that's where when my wife says, I got a bonus when I married you because I can cook, but I love to eat, but it's part of, you know, they grew up having very minimal things in life, and they make do with what they had. And what I found was cooking was a passion for my dad when he had the time on the weekend when they closed up on Sundays, the big Sunday dinner, things that you wouldn't see any other day. That was something that I look forward to. But during the weekdays, it was all work for him. So he never really had time to spend with the kids. But on Sunday, when I grew up, it was getting together with both myself, my sister, and my mom. We'll go out for family drives, whether it's berry picking in those days or just going for an adventure somewhere outside of the city. I think those are different times. I mean, it's sort of what we were exposed to growing up. The city wasn't that big at the time. So what is now a 10-minute drive into a new community was probably the country back then when I grew up. So I think my favorite memories would be spending time with my dad, whether it was Sunday fishing with him. He never had many hobbies. When you run a business, you don't have time to really sort of step back and have time for the kids in the evening. So, you know, my routine when I came home from school was, because they ran that snack bar, I had KP duty. I was peeling potatoes along with my sister. So there were delegated tasks, but I think that just stuck with me. You know, there were things that I had to do to help the business, and it wouldn't be cooking food, but it'd be doing things to take the load off their shoulders type of things that we could do by ourselves. And whether it be mopping the floors or sweeping the floors or things that were simple, but they sort of instilled values that I guess that stuck to me today. You know, you make what you can of your life in terms of what they had, and we didn't ask for much. And I know that when I grew up, you know, these traditional holidays that many of my Caucasian friends celebrated, I had no idea what they were because I was never taught that at home. We celebrated Chinese festivals, Chinese holidays. So, yeah.
And what's the Newfoundland Chinese Canadian community like? Just for us out here, even in Vancouver, is there a Chinatown that's quite distinct? Or growing up, were there other Chinese Canadian families that your family were close to?
Yeah. So my family name is Jin, but the actual Cantonese version of it is Yan, Y-A-N. So there would have been a grouping of that families or those families that came from China who sometimes were related and sometimes weren't. But then there would be the Yao clan or the Wangs. But there were several Chinese, I won't call it fraternities, but they were like little cluster clans where they had their own little building where at the time when I grew up, I didn't know what it was, but it was basically a place where the men gathered to play mahjong on Sunday. Eventually found out, but it was an opportunity for my dad. And I remember he would disappear for a few hours on a Sunday afternoon, but I didn't know where he went. And my mom would say, oh, he's got some business, but wound up to be a game of opportunity to play with men of his, you know, that he knew, just to, it's a form of relaxation. But there were society or clan associations for the Hangs, the Yao families, that sort of thing. So that went on in St. John's, but St. John's never had a real big population of Chinese relative to some of the bigger centers like Vancouver or Toronto. So, I mean, they did what they could. I mean, I know buying groceries in the days I grew up, they actually probably mail ordered from Vancouver or Toronto for things that they needed. Subtleties that maybe you find for granted now, but they look forward to ordering. So,
yeah, that's super interesting. It is something that I do remember myself growing up, relatives from Calgary or even Montreal would come to Vancouver, and the first stop would be grocery stores in Chinatown in Vancouver. And it's true, ingredients that we take for granted, like dried mushrooms or dried scallops or oyster sauce, is not so easy to get in other parts back then. I wanted to maybe talk a little bit more about the organization that you're a part of, president of the Newfoundland and Labrador Head Tax Redress Organization. Can you tell us a little bit more about it and what the work is doing?
Sure. So this organization was incorporated. I guess what had happened following the parliamentary apology was that the Government of Canada issued a proposal call through the Community Heritage Recognition Program, where interested groups, incorporated groups, can apply for funding to do programs or things that would educate the Canadian public about wartime restriction measures, immigration things. And a group of my colleagues, I guess head tax descendants, friends, supporters, decided, you know, there was a head tax in Newfoundland. Let's do something to honor our parents and friends that went through this, because it's not really well known in the history books. Here's an opportunity to do something. I wanted to do it. I just needed the support of other people to help. This was a major undertaking for us. So we incorporated, I think, a year after or somewhere just after the announcement was released. We pieced together a four-pronged project, which comprised a granite monument in downtown St. John's, which is the living legacy to this project now. There was a nine-month exhibition at the Center for Newfoundland Studies at Memorial University. There was a educational resource kit issued to the Department of Education to talk about the Chinese Immigration Act at the time, the head tax, and what occurred in the Dominion of Newfoundland from 1906 to 1949. That's within the Department of Education, targeted at the high school social studies history classes. And there was a website. In a proposal, we partner with the city of St. John's for the land. They provided us the land at the site of the first Chinese hand laundry. So there was a reason why we did it in downtown St. John's. We wanted some connection to plaquing this site, which eventually became a monument, but we wanted to honor the history of the Chinese immigration. And when many of the Chinese immigrants came to St. John's in the early part of the 20th century, they were all laundrymen. So we thought the site of the first Chinese hand laundry in St. John's would be the most significant location. So it's actually next to where this hand laundry was built. So those four things were the project, and we partner with the City of St. John's and the Grand Concourse Authority, which is a group of, it's actually a non-for-profit organization that has a major amount of trail systems in St. John's, and this Chinese head tax monument is one of the markers on their trail system. So it's been in St. John's. It was unveiled September 17, 2010, so it's been there for the last 13 years. It's quite the sight to see when that monument was unveiled. I think it was one of the highlights of what we could do to honor our ancestors, you know, because it did speak about what they did, the sacrifices they paid, and it did speak about the $300 head tax they had to pay in order to come to Newfoundland to live.
That's really, really great. It's really amazing. And it's something that in many ways feels very permanent and historic in that monumental place where people can come and realize that the Chinese were here, and they were here early, and they were really a part of Canada's history. Do you know why in particular the Chinese came over and did mainly laundries in St. John's as opposed to any other business, the beginning of it?
I think my understanding of research, it didn't take a lot of capital monies to start a hand laundry. There weren't very many at the time, obviously, so that helped them. But it didn't take a lot of education. It was long hours, basically hard work, and the Chinese were willing to do it. and willing to do it in such a manner that as time went on, more hand laundries appear. As far as we did from our research, that group that we incorporated, there was up to 24 hand laundries in St. John's during that period from 1906 to 49, scattered mostly in downtown St. John's. And eventually, when more Chinese came over and they couldn't find work within the laundries, they went off to open, whether it's restaurants, convenience stores, snack bars, and some went off into working in the smaller communities when they relocated outside of St. John's. Because I think in every community in Newfoundland, or at least those that had a substantial population, there was always a Chinese store, restaurant, or something.
Thank you so much for all of this knowledge and the great things you've told us about Newfoundland and the Chinese Canadian community there. For anyone interested in learning more about the Newfoundland Chinese head tax and the stories of those who lived it, please come and visit us at the Chinese Canadian Museum in Vancouver. Our feature exhibition, The Paper Trail to the 1923 Chinese Exclusion Act, talks about all of these stories and in particular features a special exhibit on the Newfoundland head tax and the Newfoundland Chinese exclusion certificates. So I hope that we will see each other there together, Gordon. You'll be able to come and visit us in Vancouver.
We have tickets already booked. Sometime between June 20th and 30th next summer, we'll be there.
Oh, wonderful. That's so wonderful. Thank you so much. This podcast was recorded on the traditional territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. We invite you all to reflect on the territories that you're on and the host nations. To learn more about the Chinese Canadian Museum and book tickets, visit us at ChineseCanadianMuseum.ca and follow us on Instagram at CCMuseumBC for updates. The School Room is presented by the Chinese Canadian Museum, hosted by Dr. Melissa Carmen Lee, produced by Rosalie Gonawan, and advised by Sarah Ling and Catherine Clement. Production is supported by Noah Taylor and the Walrus Lab. The theme music and original audio was created by Joshua Young, and graphic design is by Studio Pian Pian He and Max Harvey. Stay tuned for next month's episode of The School Room, available wherever you get your podcasts.